Warner Brothers Pictures presents Farley Granger, by arrangement with Samuel Goldwyn, Ruth Roman, Robert Walker. Alfred Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train, re-release. Leo G. Carroll, Patricia Hitchcock, Laura Elliott, Marion Lorne, Jonathan Hale, Howard St. John, John Brown, Norma Varden, Robert Gist. A Warner Brothers First Nation feature. Screenplay by Raymond Chandler and Chimpsey Ormond. Adaptation by Whitfield Cook from the novel by Patricia Highsmith. Director of Photography, Robert Burks, ASC. Art Director, Edward S. Howarth. Film Editor, William Ziegler. Sound by Dolph Thomas. Musical Direction by Ray Heindorf. Original Music by Dmitri Tiomkin. Directed by Alfred Hitchcock. A cab turns off a bright city street under a high stone arch into the gloom of a narrow service road and glides to a halt. A porter opens the rear door and lifts out a suitcase, revealing the elegant black and white leather shoes of a passenger who steps out, pays the cabbie, and strolls across a pavement. On a sunlit road, another cab draws up. A porter lifts out a suitcase and a pair of tennis rackets. The passenger wears smart, dark leather shoes. He pays and follows close behind the porter as they march towards a high stone building. The elegant shoes approach from the right, the smart shoes from the left, striding along a colonnade over a marble floor to join a stream of passengers converging on a railway platform. A train picks up speed as it traverses a crisscross of tracks and points. In the buffet car, the man in the elegant shoes walks past seated passengers and sits at a table, stretching his legs and crossing them. The man wearing the smart shoes approaches from the other end of the car. He sits at the same table and crosses his legs, the tip of his shoe catching the elegant shoe of his fellow passenger.
Excuse me.
The elegant passenger, sprucely dressed, takes in his fresh-faced companion.
I beg your pardon. Aren't you Guy Haynes?
The younger man smiles genially.
Oh, sure. I saw you blast Faraday right off the court in South Orange last season. Made the semifinals, didn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, I certainly admire people who do things.
He sits next to Guy.
By the way, my name is Bruno. Bruno Anthony.
He indicates his tie pin.
See?
With his name on it.
Well, I suppose you think it's corny, but my mother gave it to me, so I have to wear it to please her.
How do you do?
I don't talk much. You go ahead and read.
Thanks.
Guy turns back to his book. Bruno peers at it.
You know, it must be pretty exciting to be so important.
Tennis player isn't so important.
Oh, but people who do things are important. Me, I never seem to do anything. I suppose you're going to Southampton for the doubles.
You are a tennis fan.
Gee, I wish I could be there to watch you. But I've got to get back to Washington tomorrow. I'm from Arlington, you know.
Bruno takes a cigarette case from inside his jacket.
Cigarette?
Not now, thanks. I don't smoke much.
Me, I smoke too much.
Oh, here.
Guy hands Bruno a cigarette lighter.
Oh, elegant.
On it is engraved crisscross tennis rackets and an inscription.
From A to G. I bet I can guess who A is.
Yeah?
Ann Norton. You see, sometimes I turn the sports page and I see the society section. And the pictures. She's very beautiful. Senator Morton's daughter, huh?
You're quite a reader, Mr. Anthony.
Yes, I am. Ask me anything. I got the answer. Even news about people I don't know. Like, who would like to marry whom when his wife gets her divorce.
Perhaps you read too much.
Oh, there I go again. Too friendly. It always happens. I meet somebody who I like and admire, and I open my mouth too much.
That's all right. Forget it. I guess I'm a little jittery.
Oh, there's a new cure for that. Waiter.
Yes, sir.
Scotch and plain water, please. A pair. Doubles. The only kind of doubles I play.
Oh, you'll have to drink both of them.
And I can do it. When's the wedding?
What?
The wedding. You and Ann Morton. It was in the papers.
Well, it shouldn't have been. Unless they legalized bigamy overnight.
Oh, I've got a wonderful theory about that. Someday I'd like to tell you about it, but right now I suppose that divorce is Well, the simplest operation.
The waiter places two glasses on the table.
Well, this is wonderful, you know, having you as company all the way to New York.
Oh, as a matter of fact, I'm not going direct. I'm stopping off at Metcalf.
Metcalf? Who would want to stop off at Metcalf?
Well, it's my hometown.
Oh, I get it. A little chat with your wife about the divorce.
Close enough.
Guy picks up a glass.
Thanks, I think I will.
Well, here's luck. Drink up, and we'll have lunch sent to my compartment.
They raise glasses and sip their drinks.
Thanks very much, but I think I'll go to the dining car. Oh, waiter. Do you know if there are any vacant seats in the diner now?
Not for about 20 minutes, I'm afraid, sir.
You see, you'll have to lunch with me.
Bruno lifts his glass again.
Well, here's to the next Mrs. Haynes.
Guy looks thoughtful, then downs his drink. After lunch, sitting in Bruno's compartment.
Sure, I went to college. Got kicked out of three of them. Drinking and gambling. Not like you, huh? All right, so I'm a bum.
Who said you were?
My father. He hates me. With all the money he's got, he thinks that I ought to catch the 8-5 bus every morning, punch a time clock somewhere, and work my way up selling paint or something. Now, what do you think of a character like that?
Well, I think possibly...
Yes, I hate him, too. I tell you, I get so sore at him sometimes. I want to kill him.
I don't think you know what you want.
Well, I want to do something. Everything. You know, I've got a theory that you should do everything before you die. Have you ever driven a car blindfolded at 150 miles an hour?
Not lately.
I did. I flew in a jet plane, too. Man, that's a thrill. Almost blew the sawdust out of my head. And I'm going to make a reservation on the first rocket to the moon.
What are you trying to prove?
Well, I'm not like you, Guy. You're lucky. You're smart. Marrying the boss's daughter, that makes a nice shortcut to a career, doesn't it?
Marrying the senator's daughter has nothing to do with it. Can't a fellow look beyond a tennis net without being out for something?
Take it easy, Guy. I'm your friend, remember? I like you. I'd do anything for you.
Sure, Bruno. We'll be pulling in sooner. I've got to change trains.
What did you say her name was? Your wife's?
Miriam.
Miriam, that's it. Miriam Joyce Haynes. I suppose she played around a lot, huh?
Skip it, Bruno. It's kind of painful for a man to discover he's been a chump.
Okay.
Bruno is smoking a cigar. He fiddles with the cigarette lighter.
Want to hear one of my ideas for a perfect murder? You want to hear the busted light socket in the bathroom or the carbon monoxide in the garage?
Neither one. I may be old-fashioned, but I thought murder was against the law.
What is a life for two guys? Some people are better off dead. Like your wife and my father, for instance. Oh, that reminds me of a wonderful idea I had once. I used to put myself to sleep at night, figuring it out. Now, let's say that you'd like to get rid of your wife.
It's a morbid thought.
No. Just suppose. Let's say that you had a very good reason.
Now, let's...
Let's say. Now, you'd be afraid to kill her. You know why? You'd get caught. And what would trip you up? The motive. Ah. Now, here's my idea.
I'm afraid I haven't got time to listen, Bruce.
Listen. It's so simple, too. Two fellows meet accidentally, like you and me. No connection between them at all. Never saw each other before. Each one has somebody that he'd like to get rid of. So, they swap murders.
Swap murders?
Each fellow does the other fellow's murder. Then there's nothing to connect them. Each one has murdered a total stranger. Like, you do my murder, I do yours.
We're coming into my station.
Guy gets up.
For example, your wife, my father. Crisscross.
What?
Oh, we do talk the same language, don't we?
Well, sure, Bruno, we talk the same language. Thanks for the lunch.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I thought the lamb chops were a little overdone myself.
Nice meeting you.
Now, you think my theory's okay, Guy? You like it?
Sure, Bruno, sure. They're all okay.
Guy smiles and leaves. Bruno closes the door and leans his back against it. He sees the cigarette lighter on the table, grabs it to go after Guy, then pauses. He tosses the lighter playfully in his hand and sprawls back on the seat, feet up, studying the lighter and its inscription.
crisscross.
At a quiet small town station, the train comes to a halt and Guy steps down onto the platform, suitcase in one hand, tennis rackets in the other. A portly gentleman in a creased suit and trilby hat boards the train, heaving a double bass in front of him. Guy heads towards a smiling porter and hands over his luggage.
Hiya, Bill.
Guy Haines. Good to see you, boy. You better win at Southampton tomorrow, hear me? I got $2 on your nose.
Park these in a lucky spot for a few hours, will you?
Sure thing.
Guy strides away from the station and comes to a shop with the sign Miller's Music Store on the window. Somberly, he peers through the painted letters into the shop. A young assistant busies herself at the counter, her mousy hair swept back and braided. She wears distinctive glasses the shape of cat's eyes. As Guy walks into the shop, she is serving a customer.
150, 2, 3, 4, 5. There you are. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The assistant sees Guy and smiles. He does not return her smile.
Hello, Guy.
You're looking well, Miriam.
So are you. You got a nice tan playing tennis with all your rich friends.
What time do we meet your lawyer?
What's your hurry?
My hurry? That's funny coming from you. You're the one who's in a hurry, aren't you?
When you wouldn't give me the divorce right away, I sort of hoped maybe it was because you were a little bit jealous.
I got over being jealous a long time ago, Miriam.
An assistant looks at them. They move to a glass-paneled listening booth.
It's talking here.
A couple in the next booth glance at them as they enter. Miriam crosses her arms and sneers at Guy.
Oh, this is cozy. Sort of like old times, isn't it, Guy?
Oh, skip it, Miriam. It's pretty late to start flirting with a discarded husband. Especially when you're going to have another man's baby.
You know, I think you're handsomer than ever.
Let's see your lawyer and get this over with.
Did you bring the money? Lawyers are expensive.
Yes.
Guy takes a wallet from inside his jacket and hands her a wad of notes. She counts them out.
Here it is.
You know, if I'd known what all that tennis nonsense of yours was going to lead to, I wouldn't have run out on you.
What are you trying to say, Miriam?
I'm not getting a divorce.
You little double-crosser. I didn't want this divorce. You did. That's what you've been harping about for the past year.
It's a woman's privilege to change her mind. Now, I can buy me some pretty new clothes.
She tucks the money into her belt.
I wouldn't want you to be ashamed of me in Washington when we go to all of those dinners and swanky parties.
What do you mean by that?
Not like some mad guy. You always smile when you have your pictures taken for the newspaper. Especially when you have Ann Morton hanging on your arm.
Let's not talk about Ann Morton.
You're serious between you two, huh? Well, you can throw all your little dreams about her right into the ash can. I'm coming to Washington.
What for?
Have my baby and be with you.
Why me? It's not my baby.
Yes, but people don't know that guy, do they? Make a pretty story. The senator's daughter involved with a married man. Especially when he's about to become a father.
Oh, you conniving little liar!
Keep your voice down.
The man in the next booth is looking at them.
What happened? He run out on you?
No man runs out on me, Guy, not even you.
Now look, Miriam. You've been trying to get rid of me long enough. Now I'll go you one better. I never want to see or hear you again.
I could be very pathetic as the deserted little mother in a courtroom. Guy, think it over. Who would believe you?
I'm warning you.
He grabs her roughly. An elderly man watches from the counter as Miriam struggles to free herself. He goes to the booth.
Furthermore, that's what should happen to people like you. I'd like to find
Break it up, folks. This isn't the place for a family quarrel.
I'm sorry. I'm leaving.
You heard what I said, Guy Haines. You can't throw me away like an old shoe. I'm coming to Washington to have my baby. Tell her to the Senate!
Please.
Guy, in a telephone kiosk.
Anne? Anne, darling, I... Yes, I'm in Medcalf. Now, everything didn't go smoothly. She doesn't want the divorce. Not now.
Anne is standing in a darkly furnished room.
It's unbelievable.
She's tall, with short dark hair, and wears a white silk blouse.
Yes, I know how you must feel.
She grips the phone tightly.
But you sound so savage, Guy.
Sure I sound savage. I feel savage. I'd like to break her neck. I said I'd like to break her foul, useless little neck. What's that? I said I could strangle her.
Bruno, flexing his fingers.
I do
wish you'd keep your hands quiet. You're so restless lately.
I like them to look just right.
Did I file them too short?
Oh, no, Ma. They're just fine. Thanks.
He wears a dressing gown. His mother wears pearls.
And what's the matter?
Oh, I'm all right. Don't worry about me.
But you look so pale, dear. Are you out of vitamins?
I took a bottle yesterday, Ma. A whole fifth.
Oh, but you have that look, dear. I always can tell. Now, you haven't been doing anything foolish.
She puts her hand to his cheek. He nuzzles into it.
Well, I do hope you've forgotten all about that silly little plan of yours.
Which one?
About blowing up the White House.
Oh, Ma, I was only fooling. Besides, what would the president say?
You're a naughty boy, Bruno. Well, you can always make me laugh.
A large dog, a Great Dane, sprawls on the sitting room floor.
Now get shaved before your father gets home.
Bruno lunges forward.
I'm sick and tired of bowing and scraping to the king.
No, no. Now let's not lose control. Come see my painting.
They walk through the oak-paneled room.
Bruno, I do wish you'd take a painting. Such a soothing pastime.
They stop at a canvas on an easel. His mother gazes proudly at it, then looks at Bruno for his reaction.
Oh, Mother, you're wonderful. That's the old boy, all right. That's Father.
Is it?
It's a thin-faced, goggle-eyed swirl.
Oh, I was trying to paint St. Francis.
Excuse me, sir. They're ready with your call to Southampton.
In the hall beyond the butler, a wide door swings open and an elderly silver-haired man enters and approaches. Bruno strides resolutely past him.
Bruno, come here. I want to talk to you and your mother.
Sorry, Father. Long distance.
Bruno picks up a phone.
Darling Charles, must you always take Hello. Time with Bruno?
I was sitting around driving. And you knew about it all the time.
Guy. Bruno.
What? Now, who did you say this is?
Bruno, Guy. Bruno Anthony. Don't you remember? On the train.
Guy talks to Bruno from a locker room.
Are you getting a divorce?
Bruno takes in his parents' conversation while listening to Guy.
Oh, so she double-crossed you? Are you going to see her again?
It's just impossible. Now, just let's have lunch.
If it's the last thing I do, I'm going to have that boy taken care of. If necessary, put under restraint.
Bruno grimaces wearily. A train pulls in at Metcalfe Station. Three passengers descend to the platform, the last one, Bruno, elegantly dressed in a plain dark suit, tie and trilby hat. He takes in his surroundings and goes directly to the telephone kiosk on the station platform. A thin telephone directory hangs from a hook in the kiosk. Bruno lifts it off and flicks through it. His finger runs down a page. Hagwood, Hale, Haynes, Miriam Joyce, 2420 Metcalfe. Bruno sits patiently at a bus stop at night, smoking a thin cigar. He calmly watches a house across the road where a woman sits on a lighted porch. Miriam emerges from the house with two young men and speaks to the woman. Miriam and the men run across the road as a bus pulls up.
Hey, there's a bus!
Hold on, driver!
Hey,
driver! Hey, bus.
Hurry!
Hey, wait a minute! Driver!
Oh, wait!
Oh. I get it, Tom. Oh. Go ahead.
Okay.
Miriam wears a pretty floral dress and her cat's eye glasses. Bruno follows them onto the bus. At a fairground, the passengers get off and cross the road to the entrance of the fair.
Watch your step. He needs a tubby.
Hey, I'm hungry.
Oh, already.
Bruno is last, hovering on the pavement as the bus leaves. A large neon sign reads, Crafts, 20 big shows. Beyond are balloons and brightly lit stalls. Further off, a big wheel turns. Bruno saunters across to join the milling crowds. At the edge of the fairground, he stops to light a cigarette and watch Miriam at an ice cream stall.
Vanilla.
I think I should have had a hot dog before I had this.
A hot dog?
That's where I find like craving a little better.
Craving for what?
Why, I never saw a girl eat so much in all my life.
Miriam catches sight of the elegant man in the trilby.
Oh, well, you put it all. Hey, this is good. Want some money, Doc?
She licks her ice cream and looks at him. Motionless, Bruno watches her.
Hey, are we going to go to the tunnel, Bob?
The tunnel of what? Come on.
Bruno moves after them. Miriam looks over her shoulder and smiles. A little boy in a cowboy suit carrying a balloon and a toy gun steps in front of Bruno.
Pick him up. Bang, bang.
He jabs his cigarette at the balloon and strides on. She leads them to a show your strength attraction. Bruno follows.
1600. Who else wants to take a chance and win a Cupid doll?
That's the chance.
Here we go. Watch it.
One of the men swings the hammer. The marker goes halfway up.
16. How about you, sir? Thank you.
The other man takes the hammer. Miriam looks out for Bruno. She can't see him.
1700. You did not win the Cupid doll that time. Will you try it again, sir?
When she turns back, he's standing beside her.
Here we go. Watch it now.
They exchange a glance.
1600. Will you try it again and win a nice Cupid doll with a lady? Try your luck, mister.
Bruno steps forward. Miriam watches him approvingly. Bruno pays the attendant, rubs his palms together, inspects his hands, then looks at Miriam. She regards him coquettishly.
Here we go!
He picks up the hammer and takes careful aim. She looks at him with admiration.
You've just won a Cupid doll. Why, he's broken the thing!
He lifts his eyebrows at her. She smoulders. She turns to go. Her companions lead her to a merry-go-round, handing over money at a kiosk. She turns back to Bruno and smiles invitingly. The carousel slows to a halt and they climb aboard. Bruno strolls to the kiosk, pays the attendant, and hops on the platform as it begins to turn. He picks his way between the shiny painted horses. As three abreast, they slowly rise and fall. He passes between the two young men. Miriam sits side-saddle on the outermost horse. Bruno mounts the horse behind her. Miriam turns and smiles. The carousel picks up speed.
Hey, let's sing, come on.
Daisy was born with a strawberry plum as a band player. He crossed the floor with the girl he adored as a
Miriam looks back at Bruno. He sings along and smiles. When she turns back, his smile fades.
The poor girl would shake with alarm. He nearly the girl with the strawberry girl as a band.
Miriam dismounts. The two young men take her by the hand. They run to the next attraction, Bruno following. One of the men puts an arm around her.
Oh, it's all fun, Nick, with a mouthful of popcorn. All of one.
They hurry onto a pontoon. Bruno buys popcorn and follows, under a sign reading Magic Isle. Munching popcorn, he watches a boatman help Miriam and the two young men to board a small motorboat. Across the water is a dark cave marked Tunnel of Love. As they set off, Miriam glances flirtatiously at Bruno. He walks down the pontoon and hands a ticket to the boatman, who helps him into an empty boat. Bruno sits at the wheel. The attendant pushes him off. Weaving beneath a string of Chinese lanterns, Miriam's boat heads for the tunnel. Bruno stuffs popcorn into his mouth and steers towards her. She glances back again as her boat glides into the cave. Bruno's boat reaches the tunnel. Inside, the lantern light throws shadows of the two boats and their occupants on the tunnel wall. Bruno's shadow closes in on hers. Miriam's boat emerges from the tunnel. One of the men is tickling her. Bruno's boat emerges close behind. Miriam's boat lands at a grassy island, and the occupants jump out.
Let's not break a leg. We got news for you later.
The island is in darkness. The lights of the fairground some way off. Bruno's boat glides in next to Miriam's. He steps off the boat as Miriam runs to hide from her companions.
Hey, Miriam!
She halts. A cigarette lighter illuminates her face. She smiles.
Is your name Miriam?
Why, yes. How did you...
The flame goes out. Gloved hands grip her throat. Her glasses fall off onto the grass, next to the lighter. Reflected in a lens is a silhouette of Bruno in his trilby hat, his hands at Miriam's neck. She struggles to release his grip, but weakens and slumps. Still gripping her throat, he slowly lowers her body to the ground. He picks up the glasses and the lighter and strides away. Bruno marches briskly between courting couples lying in the grass.
Lost your girl, George?
Hey, here she is.
Bruno hops onto the boat as couples get up and move towards the noise.
Look, she's fainted. Come on, Miriam, get up.
He backs away from the island and heads across the lake towards the fairground.
She's dead. Help, somebody, help!
Somebody send a doctor!
Somebody send for a doctor, help!
Back at the fairground pontoon, a boatman helps two anxious women disembark. Another boatman helps Bruno off his boat. A crowd is gathering excitedly. Bruno edges through them and exchanges a look with the boatman, who watches him leave, then turns to his assistant.
Go get a cop. I don't know what's going on over there.
The assistant moves off. At the fairground entrance, Bruno sees a man with a white stick and dark glasses hesitate at the roadside. He takes the man's arm, waits for a car to pass, and walks with him across the road, holding up a hand to halt another car. Reaching the opposite pavement, the man thanks Bruno and walks away. With a smug grin, Bruno looks at his watch. It's precisely 9:30. Guy, reading a magazine in the lounge of a train, checks his watch and glances at the only other occupant, an older man in a black tie.
Indeed he did. He loved that goat, just like a kid.
He turns and looks at Guy.
What's your opinion?
Well, you'll never make the Metropolitan.
Name's Collins. On sabbatical, Delaware Tech. Glad to meet you.
Guy nods pleasantly.
I just made a speech in New York on integration. In differential calculus, a function is given and the differential is obtained. You understand?
Yes, I understand.
You do? There was a man who had a goat.
Guy smiles and returns to his magazine. On a lamplit cobbled street, a cab pulls up by the steps of an imposing terrace of houses. Guy gets out, sets down a suitcase, and pays the driver. In the distance is the floodlit white dome of the US Capitol building. The cab drives off. Guy picks up his suitcase and goes up the steps.
Guy.
He opens the front door, then turns. Under a street lamp on the other side, a high wrought iron gate stands ajar. He looks again, but the street seems deserted. A shadowy figure in a trilby hat emerges from behind the gate and beckons. Guy sets down the suitcase just inside the door and descends the steps. At the pavement, he halts and frowns into the shadows beyond the gate where the figure lurks. He crosses the street and approaches the gate.
Hello, Guy.
What are you doing here at this time of night?
Well, you don't seem very pleased to see me. I brought you a little present.
What do you mean?
Bruno presents him with Miriam's glasses.
Oh, what's this all about?
Recognize them?
Guy turns them in his fingers. One cat's eye lens is shattered.
It was very quick, Guy. She wasn't hurt in any way. It was all over in no time. I knew you'd be surprised. And Guy, there's nothing for us to worry about. Nobody saw me. Only Miriam. And I was very careful, Guy. Even when I dropped your cigarette lighter there, I went back to pick it up.
Are you trying to tell me? Why, you maniac!
But, Guy, you wanted it. We planned it on the train together, remember? Where are you going?
Where do you think I'm going? I'm gonna call the police, of course.
But you can't, Guy. We'd both be arrested for murder.
We'd both be arrested for murder?
You're just as much in it as I am. We planned it together. Crisscross.
Are you crazy, fool? Do you think you can get away with that?
Oh, come now, Guy. Why should I go to Metcalf to kill a total stranger? Unless it was part of the plan and you were in on it. You're the one who benefits, Guy. You're a free man now. I didn't even know the girl.
I had nothing to do with this. The police will believe me.
Guy, if you go to the police now, you'll just be turning yourself in as an accessory. You see, you have the motive.
Guy slowly meets Bruno's gaze. Guy looks up at a darkened first-floor window of the house.
What is it?
My telephone.
Someone has some news for you, Guy.
A black car draws up outside the house.
It's the police.
Guy retreats into the shadows and stands next to Bruno. They watch as a policeman goes up the steps and enters the house. The policeman's shadow appears at the door. He descends to the car.
You've got me acting like I'm a criminal. Are you crazy fool?
A steely glint flashes in Bruno's eyes.
Don't you call me that.
Guy looks alarmed and nervous.
Oh, you must be tired, Guy. I know I am. I've had a strenuous evening. But now, Guy, about my father. See, I've got a plan of the house already made. And I have an old Luger pistol, which I picked up in a pawn shop in San Francisco.
Guy leaves.
But Guy, wait a minute. We have to talk. We have to arrange
things. Get away before I give you what you gave Miriam.
Oh, you're not yourself, Guy. You're tired. Now, when you think things over, you'll see that I'm right. Tomorrow,
I don't know you. I never saw you before. I never want to see you again. But we have...
Guy rushes into the house. Bruno walks down the steps, then turns and looks at the door. In the upstairs room, Guy is on the phone. He's holding Miriam's glasses.
Yes? Yes, Anne. Well, I'm sorry, darling. I just got in. Of course I'm all right. But you sound upset. Is anything wrong? All right. I'll come over right away.
He puts down the phone and looks at the glasses. Guy stands at the white front door of a large house. The door is opened by Anne. She looks distraught. He goes to her. Inside, they kiss passionately, full on the lips. Her eyes are closed, so are his.
Anne, darling, you're trembling.
She looks at him, glances down the hallway, then walks him slowly away from the front door.
Guy, I wonder if you know how much I love you.
Brazen woman, I'm the one to say that.
They kiss again. She melts into his arms. He cradles her head with his hand.
I wanted you to know before. Father wants to see you.
Guy looks down the hallway. Side by side, they walk towards an open door. She goes in first. Guy follows, discreetly wiping his lips with a handkerchief as he closes the door. An elderly man in smart dressing gown and white cravat stands next to Anne at a fireplace. He has neatly parted hair and a thin moustache.
Good evening, sir.
A teenage girl wearing glasses sits beside them. All three look at him uncertainly.
Hello, Babs.
The girl leaps up with a grin and kisses his cheek.
Something dreadful's happened, Guy.
Sit down, Barbara.
She meekly resumes her seat. The man looks somberly at Guy.
There seems to be no way of diplomatically breaking tragic news. I'm sorry, Guy, to be the one to tell you. It concerns your wife. She's been murdered.
police have been trying to locate you everywhere.
You ought to call headquarters in Medcar.
Guy turns away and slowly lowers himself into a seat by the wall.
Miriam murdered.
She was strangled.
Guy meets her gaze. Babs gets a whiskey for her father.
It happened on an island in an amusement park. It was sort of a lover's lane, I believe. Evidently a sordid atmosphere.
Miriam went there with two boys. They're the ones who found her, so they're not suspects. But you probably will be.
Young lady, there's no overlooking the fact that murder is at our doorstep, but I wish you wouldn't drag it into the living room.
Well, let's not fool ourselves. Police will say Guy wanted Miriam out of the way so he could marry Anne. The crime of this sort, the police first go after the husband anyway, and Guy had every motive.
Motive?
But she's right. Whichever way you look at it, well, I'm in a spot.
Oh, come now, my boy. I'm sure you've got nothing to worry about.
If he has an alibi for 9:30 tonight, he has plenty to worry about.
You can tell them where you were.
Sherry.
Thank you.
Babs hands Anne a glass.
Can't you, Guy?
9:30? I was on the train from New York to Washington.
There you are.
Who saw you? Did you speak to anyone? You'll need a witness.
Oh, yes, I did speak to someone.
Someone you know?
No. His name was... Collins. He's a professor.
Harvard?
Delaware Tech.
Anne's father looks bemused.
Then everything's all right.
Not quite. He'll still have to answer questions.
Routine, pure routine.
I'm afraid there'll be a lot of reporters at your front door in the morning.
Oh, Daddy doesn't mind a little scandal. He's a senator.
Can't be helped, darling. It's not your fault. It's not as though anyone can say you had anything to do with it.
Well, someone might say it. I'd do anything to keep you all out of this mess.
Be guided by my experience. Never lose any sleep over accusations. Unless they can be proved, of course. Dreadful business, dreadful. Poor, unfortunate girl.
She was a tramp.
She was a human being. Let me remind you that even the most unworthy of us has a right to life in the pursuit of happiness.
From what I hear, she pursued it in all directions.
Barbara.
Father, it's getting terribly late. Guy looks so tired.
Of course, of course. Back to bed, Barbara.
Well, you two, nothing stands in your way now. You can be married right away. Think of it. You're free.
One doesn't always have to say what one thinks.
Father, I am not a politician.
You won't forget that call, Guy. Captain Turley.
Yes, sir. Good night.
Babs goes with her father, but turns back.
Anne.
I still think it'd be wonderful to have a man love you so much he'd kill for you.
She leaves.
I kept saying over and over I was being silly. But there was one horrible moment tonight when the news came through. I kept remembering what you shouted on the phone from Medgar.
That I could strip.
Don't even say it. Forget you ever said it. Even more terrifying than the murder itself was the horrible thought that if you had had anything to do with it, we would have been separated. Perhaps forever. I couldn't stand that. I couldn't bear it.
She kisses him, her eyes closed. His are open. A police sergeant sits typing at a desk. Guy approaches down a corridor.
Captain Turley's expecting me. Guy Haynes.
Just a moment, Mr. Haynes.
The sergeant leaves his desk. Guy looks around him nervously. He catches sight of Professor Collins sitting in an adjoining room and smiles in greeting. The man looks blankly at Guy.
Would you come in, please?
Guy goes through into a room. Inside are two middle-aged men in suits.
Good of you to be so prompt, Mr. Haynes. This is Lieutenant Campbell.
How do you do?
Won't you sit down?
Thank you, sir.
I know you're a busy man, so we won't detain you any longer than necessary.
Campbell moves to the door.
Now, you've already been good enough to tell us where you were last evening. And we've managed to locate the gentleman you spoke with on the train.
Yes, I saw him outside.
Will you come in, please, Professor?
The lieutenant ushers the professor into the room. The professor carries a hat and coat and wears a sober expression.
Professor Collins, this is Mr. Haynes. He was with you on the train last night.
The professor looks at Guy and frowns.
I'm terribly sorry, but I really don't remember meeting this gentleman. Unfortunately, I remember very little of our trip from New York. You see, we had a little celebration.
But, well, we were sitting opposite each other in the observation car. You were singing a song about a goat.
A goat?
And calculus. You were going over a speech you'd made.
I was? I'm very sorry, Mr. Haynes. I certainly must have been celebrating.
Guy looks away despondently.
Captain, is it so important whether or not Professor Collins remembers me? Surely the important thing is I've been able to name a man who was on the train with me. You've been able to find him. Isn't that proof of where I was at 9:30 last night?
Guy arrives back at the senator's house.
Hello, dear. Senator, Babs.
Hello, darling. Have you had dinner?
On the train.
Well, you haven't been in Medcalf all this time. We expected you hours ago.
I didn't. They sometimes throw a suspect in the can and leave him there all night.
Sit down, Guy, sit down. Barbara, some coffee. You had no trouble, of course, with the police once they verified your alibi.
When an alibi is full of bourbon, sir, it can't stand up.
You mean the professor was boiled?
Babs hands him coffee.
Completely. He didn't remember me.
But you knew he was on the train. Wasn't that enough to prove that you were on it, too?
Apparently not at the right time. They suggested I could have caught the train at Baltimore after Miriam was murdered. Well, they had it all worked out in a little timetable.
Well, that's ridiculous. They're acting as if you were guilty.
Oh, everything will be all right, Anne. The police were just being thorough. Weren't they, Daddy?
I certainly hope so. What's your next move?
Whatever it is, the police will know about it. Oh, they gave me a present.
He puts down his coffee and goes to the window.
Take a look.
He parts the curtain. Across the street, they see a man in suit and hat.
My guardian angel.
You're being tailed.
That's Leslie Hennessy. He works 16 hours a day. Somebody else takes over for the next 8. As a matter of fact, Hennessy's a very nice fellow.
I'll have him called off immediately.
Obstructing the wheels of justice, Daddy?
And I'm afraid where I go, Hennessy goes, even to the Senate.
Is he likely to pick at my office?
Very likely.
I would suggest, Guy, for your own peace of mind, of course, that you work here at the house for a few days. It would be less embarrassing for you.
But then what about practicing? Perhaps I better forget about Forest Hills.
My dear boy, wouldn't it look rather awkward if you suddenly canceled all your plans?
He's right, Guy. You mustn't do anything that looks suspicious. You've got to go on acting as though nothing had happened.
I'm escorted by Mr. Hennessy.
A butler enters with a phone.
A call for you, Mr. Haynes. They say it's urgent.
Thank you. Excuse me. Hello?
It's Bruno.
Hello, Guy.
Behind him, the dome of Capitol Hill. Guy hangs up.
Must have been some mistake. It wasn't for me.
In bright sunshine, Guy and Hennessy walk past the white colonnaded building of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I suppose I was pretty lucky being seated 5th, really.
You know, I've never seen the Forest Hills tournament before. I'm kind of looking forward to it.
You mean we'll be going there together, Hennessy?
Ah, don't worry about it. By that time, this thing will be all cleared up. Did you ever think of turning professional, Guy?
I don't have to do that. When I'm through with tennis, I'm going into politics. I hope.
Politics?
Guy sees Bruno.
It's a good thing for you I don't report that to the chief. If he knew you were getting into that rat race, he'd put 10 men on your trail. He says that...
Let's take this cab. It's getting late.
Guy bundles Hennessy into a waiting cab.
Pentagon
Building. Oh, no, not there. I always get lost.
As the car passes the steps of the Supreme Court, Guy peers up at the tiny figure of Bruno, standing beneath towering stone columns, motionless. Guy glances at Hennessy, who is attempting to light a cigarette. Morning light streams through wide double windows onto a carpeted living room. A door at the far end stands open, revealing an unmade bed. Guy emerges in pajamas, tying the belt of a dressing gown. He picks up an envelope from the floor, opens it, and pulls out a handwritten letter. Dear Guy, we must get together and make plans. My father will be going away soon. Call me. B. Guy reflects for a moment, then crumples the letter. He goes to a low table, lights a match, and sets the paper alight. In a palatial art gallery, Guy and Anne walk arm in arm.
Well, we'd better be getting back.
We've actually been alone for an hour. Seems almost indecent. You're lying.
I like.
I was beginning to feel like a goldfish.
Guy!
They turn and see Bruno standing some way off among black marble columns.
Excuse me.
Guy walks over to talk to Bruno, who steps forward to meet him.
Will you stop pestering me?
You're spoiling everything. You're making me come out into the open.
Anne sees Bruno's tie pin with Bruno on it.
I tried calling you on the phone. Didn't you get my note?
Why haven't you called me? My father is leaving for Florida the end of next week.
Now listen, you... There's a detective outside. He will see us together.
Bruno looks over at Anne.
Isn't that Anne Morton? Slight improvement over Miriam. Okay.
Stay away from me, I'm telling you.
Guy returns to Anne and takes her arm, walking her away from Bruno.
Who is it, Guy?
Oh, I never saw him before. Just some tennis fan.
Anne glances back at Bruno, who smiles motionless. In a study, Guy is looking through mail with Babs and a secretary.
Here's a special delivery, Mr. Haynes. It's marked personal.
Thank you.
You getting any practice today, Guy?
Yes, if I can get a court at the club.
Inside an envelope is a plan of Bruno's house.
Barbara, who are you waving at? Mr. Hennessy. I think it's a shame Daddy won't let us have him in to sit down. You met him yet, Louise?
No.
He's awfully cute.
Taped to the plan is a front door key. A crowd is watching a doubles tennis match. Guy, in tennis shorts and shirt, strides towards a bench under the umpire's chair, where a man and woman also in tennis gear are seated.
Hi.
Hello, Guy. Hello.
He sits next to them and looks at the crowd on the other side of the court. All heads are turning, first this way, then that, as they follow the ball. All heads but one, Bruno, who is sitting motionless in the middle of the stand. He is staring directly at Guy. Perturbed, Guy looks away. When he looks back, he sees Bruno is getting up and casually making his way to a central aisle of steps. Hands in pockets, he strides up the steps. The man on the bench next to Guy now stands behind him, holding a tennis racket.
Okay, you ready, Guy?
Guy is distracted by the sight of Bruno departing.
Oh, yeah.
He jumps up, takes off the jumper from around his neck and accompanies the man onto the court. Later, putting his jumper back on, he climbs the steps to a cafe area of tables and chairs under parasols. He freezes. At one of the tables sits Anne with an older couple and Bruno.
This is Mr. Anthony, a friend of Monsieur and Madame Darville. Guy Haynes.
I've been a fan of yours for a long time, Mr. Haynes. In fact, I follow everything you do.
Mr. Anthony has been telling us some charming stories. Very funny. Est-ce que vous connaissez l'histoire du croque-mort?
Anne is smiling politely. Then she notices Bruno's tie pin with Bruno on it. Her smile fades. She looks away uncertainly, then glances at Guy. Babs is standing a few paces away. He goes over to her.
I've just been talking to your shadow. Guy, did you know Mr. Hennessy helped crack that axe murder I was reading about? You know, the one where the body was cut up and hidden in the butcher shop. He was locked in the icebox with the left leg for 6 hours.
Oh, Babs, he pulls those things out of his head.
Who's the interesting-looking Frenchman with the darlings?
His name's Anthony. He's not French.
Babs goes over to them.
Bonjour, madame, monsieur. How are you?
Delightful to see you, Miss Barbara. How sweet you look.
I hope you aren't forgetting our little party on Thursday, madame.
We're planning on it.
But of course.
This is my sister Barbara. Barbara, this is Mr. Anthony.
How do you do?
Bruno gazes at Babs, transfixed. He nods mechanically and stares at her glasses.
Is your name Miriam?
Reflected in their lenses, he seems to see the flame of a cigarette lighter. Babs stares back at him. Anne watches Bruno with concern. Standing at a desk, by the light of a table lamp, Guy unwraps a small postal package to reveal an old Luger pistol. He warily examines the gun. He glances around the room, turns to a cabinet and slides open a narrow drawer. He places the gun inside and closes the drawer. He goes to open the door. Hennessy walks in and throws his coat over a chair.
Hiya, Hennessy.
Hi.
Won't keep you out late tonight.
Oh.
With Forest Hills coming up tomorrow, I've got to get some sleep.
Oh, that's too bad. Hammond will be coming on duty in a couple of hours. I'd like to see him earn his salary.
Doesn't that bloodhound ever relax? He sticks so close, he's beginning to grow on me. Like a fungus.
He thinks you're a very suspicious character. But then he doesn't trust anybody. Not even himself.
His back to Hennessy, Guy takes a handkerchief from the drawer with the gun in it.
Come on, Hennessy. Don't forget your sleeping bag.
Oh, yeah. If I wait too long on a sidewalk, my feet get cold. And if I have to sit too long on those stone steps,
Don't worry. Ever since you told Barbara Morton about that icebox, you've become her favorite charity. She'll send the butler out to defrost
you. Cute kid.
They exit. A formal social gathering at the senator's house. Anne wears diamond earrings and a strapless evening dress. She's with her father and a couple of guests. She smiles distractedly and glances around the room, noticing Guy is standing alone, fiddling absently with an empty cocktail glass. Babs comes up to him. They smile and exchange a few words. She takes his empty glass and goes. Ill at ease, he looks around him, catching sight of someone. Anne follows his gaze and sees Bruno in white tie and tails. Anne watches curiously. He approaches Guy with a smile, his hand outstretched. Guy does not take it. Bruno sees Anne watching them and makes a beeline for her.
Good evening, Miss Morton.
This is Mr. Anthony, Father.
Mr. Anthony.
How do you do, sir?
I'd like to talk with you sometime, sir, and tell you about my idea for harnessing the life force. It'll make atomic power look like the horse and buggy. I'm already developing my faculty for seeing millions of miles. And, Senator, can you imagine being able to smell a flower on the planet Mars? I'd like to have lunch with you someday soon, sir, and tell you more about it. I'll see you later, won't I?
As Bruno moves away, the senator watches him bemused. He turns to his daughter.
I don't remember inviting that young man. Who is he?
Friend of the Darvilles.
Unusual personality.
Babs hands Guy a full cocktail glass. They see Bruno introducing himself to a guest.
Aren't you Judge Donahue?
That's right.
How do you do, sir? My name is Anthony, Bruno Anthony.
How do you do?
What's he doing here?
I don't know.
Babs moves away. Guy continues to watch.
Tell me, Judge, after you've sentenced a man to the chair, isn't it difficult to go out and eat your dinner after that?
A guest taps Guy on the shoulder. He turns away from Bruno.
When a murderer is caught, he must be tried. When he is convicted, he must be sentenced. When he is sentenced to death, he must be executed.
A woman next to them listens.
Quite impersonal, isn't it?
So it is. Besides, it doesn't happen every day.
So few murderers are caught.
The judge leaves.
Mr. Anthony, you seem very interested in the subject of murder.
Well, no more than anyone else. No more than you, for instance.
Me? Oh, I'm not interested in murder.
Oh, come now. Everyone's interested in that. Everyone has somebody that they want to put out of the way. Oh, now, surely, madam, you're not going to tell me that there hasn't been a time that you didn't want to dispose of someone? Your husband, for instance?
Good heavens, no.
Are you sure? Do you mean to tell me that there wasn't a tiny moment when you were made very angry? What did you say? There you are, you see? There you are.
He sits in front of the woman.
Now.
She and her friend lean forward.
You're going to do a murder.
They are both agog.
How are you going to do it? That's the fascinating part. How are you going to do it? I didn't get your name.
Mrs. Cunningham.
Mrs. Cunningham. Yes. How are you going to do it?
Well, I suppose I'll have to get a gun from somewhere.
Oh, no, Mrs. Cunningham. Bang, bang, bang all over the place. Blood everywhere.
How about a little poison? Yes.
Oh, that's better. That's better, Mrs.
Anderson.
Oh, that's better, Mrs. Anderson. But you see, Mrs. Cunningham's in a dreadful hurry. Poison could take anywhere from 10 to 12 weeks if poor Mr. Cunningham is going to die from natural causes.
You know, I read of a case once. I think it would be a wonderful idea. I can take him out in the car, and when we get to a very lonely spot, knock him on the head with a hammer, pour gasoline over him and over the car, and set the whole thing ablaze.
Then have to walk all the way home? No. Oh, no, no, no. Oh. I have the best way and the best tools.
His hands.
Simple, silent, and quick. The silent part being the most important. Let me show you what I mean. You don't mind if I borrow your neck for a moment, do you?
Well, if it's not for long.
Sipping his cocktail, he scrutinizes Mrs. Cunningham. She lifts her head to expose her neck. He encircles her throat with his fingers.
Now, when I nod my head, you just try to cry out, and I bet you can't do it.
Babs is watching.
All right, now. Just wait for the nod of my head.
He is about to squeeze when he catches sight of Babs. Once again, he stares at her transfixed. She stares mutely back, immobilized, her dark eyes framed by her glasses. He stares up motionless at Babs. His hands are tight around the woman's throat.
Mr. Anthony, Mr. Anthony, help, help, help! Somebody come, quick, help!
His hands are prized away.
Somebody come, quick, bring some water!
Bruno collapses to the floor. Guests comfort the distraught Mrs. Cunningham. Guy bends over Bruno's unconscious body. A guest helps him to carry Bruno away.
Let's get him out of here.
Bring him into the study, General.
Anne tends to Mrs. Cunningham.
Will you help me take her upstairs, please?
What happened?
I don't know. He seemed to have fainted.
What was the matter with the lady?
She was just frightful.
I think we're playing a game of some sort.
The guests move away. Babs remains rooted to the spot. In the study on a settee, Bruno lies unconscious, watched by Guy and the Senator.
I thought he was a bit weird when he arrived. Who is he?
I hardly know him, sir.
Well, get him out of here as soon as you decently can, will you? This is a nice item for the gossips. First thing you know, they'll be talking about orgies. I'd better get back.
Yes, sir.
Bruno's eyes flicker. The Senator leaves. Groggily, Bruno gets to his feet. Guy pushes him down. Bruno puts a hand to his head.
What happened? I was in a merry-go-round somewhere. It made me dizzy.
You mad, crazy maniac. You ought to be locked up. Will you get out of here and let me alone?
Bruno gets to his feet again.
But Guy, I like you.
Guy punches him. Bruno falls back on the settee, nursing his chin. Guy rubs the knuckles of his hand.
You shouldn't have done that, Guy.
Come on, pull yourself together.
With difficulty, Bruno stands. He is trying unsuccessfully to fasten his bow tie.
Here, let me.
Guy ties it for him as Bruno sways unsteadily.
Your car here?
Driver's outside.
Right, come on.
Guy takes Bruno by the arm and helps him to the door. He leads Bruno past a huddle of guests. The butler opens the front door. Dazed, Babs watches them leave. Anne runs down the stairs. Babs goes to her. She takes Babs gently by the shoulders.
What's the matter, Barbara? Did you see it happen?
He looked at me. His hands were on her throat. And he was strangling me.
How do you mean?
He was looking at her first. They looked over at me. It went into sort of a trance. Oh, it was horrible. He thought he was murdering me.
Babs lowers her head and removes her glasses. Anne stares at them.
But why me, Anne? Why me? What did I have to do with it?
Anne has a determined look on her face.
Do you know where Guy is?
He went out with that man.
Babs replaces her glasses and gives her a kiss and rushes past the butler.
Excuse me.
Through the front door and looks out into the lamplit street.
Guy?
Guy sees off a black limousine. He turns and comes towards her. She goes to meet him. They stand face to face on the pavement.
You didn't meet him for the first time the other day, did you, Guy?
You mean when you introduced us at the club?
Yes. Did you notice how he stared at Barbara then?
No, I didn't particularly.
He stared at Barbara the same way tonight, while his hands were around Mrs. Cunningham's throat. What did Miriam look like?
Why do you ask me? You've seen her picture in the papers.
Go on, I want you to tell me.
She was dark, not too tall, rather pretty.
What else?
What else is there?
She wore glasses, didn't she, Guy?
Yes.
She looked something like Barbara, didn't she? How did you get him to do it?
I get him to do it.
He killed Miriam, didn't he? Tell me, didn't he?
Yes. He's a maniac. I met him on the train going to Medcalf. He had some crazy scheme about exchanging murders. I do his murder, he'd do mine.
What do you mean? Your murder, Guy?
He'd read about me in the papers.
He knew about Miriam, about you. He suggested that if he got rid of Miriam for me, I should kill his father.
You must have known he was talking nonsense.
But he wasn't. Of course I didn't give it another thought. And now a lunatic wants me to kill his father.
It's too fantastic.
Yes, isn't it?
You mean you've known about Miriam all this time?
Since the first night he gave me your glasses.
Why didn't you call the police?
And have them say what you did. Mr. Haynes, how did you get him to do it? And Bruno would say we planned it together.
Guy, what are we gonna do?
I don't know, and I don't know.
We better go inside. Friend Hennessy is watching us.
Oh, you see, Anne, this is why I didn't want you to know anything about it. I wanted to protect all of you. Barbara, your father. Now that you know, you're acting guilty, too.
If we could only talk to Father, to someone.
It's not good, Anne. I mustn't drag anyone else into this.
He glances over at Hennessy.
Come on, let's go.
Guy takes her arm and they walk back to the house. Across the street, a man approaches Hennessy.
Hello, Hannah.
Hennessy is watching the couple closely.
What's wrong? You look worried.
You better keep on your toes. Something funny's going on.
In his living room, Guy stands by the desk in shirt sleeves, his bow tie loose, studying a telephone directory by the light of the lamp. He picks up the phone.
Bruno? Yes. Yes, it's Guy. I've decided to do what you want. I'll make that little visit to your father. How about tonight? Yes, I want to get this thing over with. Does anyone know you've come home? You better slip out again. And stay out till after daylight.
He replaces the receiver. Now the room is in darkness. He wears a jacket and striped tie. He slides a drawer open to reveal the gun, which he slips into his inside jacket pocket. Dim light from the street slants across his face through an open window. He glances down at a man in a hat who paces beneath a street lamp, puffing at a cigarette. Under cover of darkness, Guy clambers down a fire escape. Now, by moonlight, he strides across a wide lawn towards a rambling country house. Along an open terrace, under canvas awnings, he approaches the wide front door. He gets out the key. Glancing behind him, he unlocks the door and enters. An oak-paneled hall leading to a sitting room. Moonlight seeps across faded carpets and gleams on heavy furniture and a crystal chandelier. From his pocket, he takes the plan of Bruno's house and by torchlight follows a line of arrows drawn along the outline of a staircase. He glances up and sees the staircase. Checking the plan, he follows the arrows across the outline of a landing, a corridor with two doors off it, the second leading to my father's room. The position of the bed is clearly marked. He pockets the map and torch and makes slowly for the stairs. On a landing halfway up the stairs, quite motionless, stands an alert Great Dane. Guy halts. He moves steadily up the stairs. The dog stands its ground, ears pricked, jaws slavering. Guy reaches the dog. It licks his hands. He pats its head and edges past, moves across the landing to a second flight of stairs and cautiously makes his way up. He walks along a corridor, hesitates at the first door, moves on, and halts at the second. He pulls out the gun from inside his jacket, checks it, slips it into his side pocket, opens the door. carefully closes the door behind him, steps forward into the gloom and towards a bed.
Mr. Anthony.
Under the bedclothes, someone stirs.
Mr. Anthony, don't be alarmed, but I must talk to you about your son. About Bruno, Mr. Anthony.
The figure in the bed turns on the light.
Yes, Mr. Haynes?
It's Bruno, in full evening dress. He swivels his legs off the bed and sits looking up at Guy.
My father isn't home tonight, Mr. Haynes. I was about to tell you that over the phone, but you made such a sudden decision. I wondered why.
Since you sent me the key to your house, I decided to use it. To make a little social call on your father. I thought he'd be interested to know he has a lunatic son.
Bruno moves towards him threateningly, then sits in a chair.
Well, then am I correct, Mr. Haynes, in assuming that you have no intention of going ahead with our arrangement?
None whatsoever. I never had.
I see. Well, then you'll have no further use for my key.
He holds out his hand. Guy gives him the key.
Nor this.
He throws the gun on the bed.
Look, Bruno, you're terribly sick. I don't know much about these things, but why don't you go someplace where you can get some kind of treatment? Not only for your own sake, but you can't go on causing more and more destruction to anyone you happen to meet.
Bruno gets up and puts his face close to Guy's.
I don't like to be double-crossed.
He moves behind Guy, picking up the gun.
I have a murder on my conscience, but it's not my murder, Mr. Haynes. It's yours.
He points the gun at Guy.
And since you're the one to profit by it, I think you should be the one to pay for it.
Well, I guess it's no use, Bruno. We seem to have nothing further to discuss.
Guy turns his back on Bruno and walks out of the room. Bruno follows along the corridor, down the stairs. At the half landing where the dog still waits, Guy glances back at Bruno, then walks steadily down the lower flight of stairs. Bruno and dog remain on the half landing, looking down at Guy. Bruno points the gun at Guy's back. Guy reaches the hallway and, keeping his eyes on Bruno, walks slowly to the door. Bruno looks down at him, still pointing the gun.
Don't worry, I'm not going to shoot you, Mr. Haynes. It might disturb Mother. I'm a very clever fellow. I'll think of something better than that. Much better.
Guy moves into the shadows and reaches the door. Hammond and Hennessy pace under the lamp outside Guy's house.
Came back at 3:25. I didn't even know he gave me the slip until I heard his phone ringing for about half an hour. Nobody sleeps that sound, so I got the janitor to let me in. No Haynes.
I wonder where he went.
Probably hear of another dame murdered.
Shut up. I better contact Metcalf. I should think this calls for more questioning, Mr. Haynes.
Questioning? Let's take him in.
My dear Mr. Hammond, how many times do I have to tell you that we have nothing conclusive on Haynes? There's no evidence that he was ever at the scene of the crime. Now, can't you get that into your thick head? Now, just stay put till I get back here.
Hennessy walks off. Daytime at Bruno's house. Mrs. Anthony is sitting in the living room with Anne.
Miss Morton, really, I know Bruno has been in some very awkward scrapes, but nothing so ridiculous as a murder.
Mrs. Anthony, you have to make him do something about this. Don't you see that just one word from him would get Guy out of this dreadful situation?
But Miss Morton, you know, I'm sure that this whole thing is just some practical joke. You know, Bruno, he sometimes goes a little too far. You know, I really shouldn't be saying this to an outsider, but sometimes he's terribly irresponsible and gets into all kinds of escapades.
Don't you understand, Mrs. Anthony? Your son is responsible for a woman's death.
Did Bruno tell you this?
Of course not, Mrs. Anthony.
Well, there you are. Well, now, Miss Morton, it's very nice of you to call. And if you'll excuse me, I must get back to my painting. Do you care for painting, Miss Morton? I find it very soothing.
Mrs. Anthony puts out her hand.
Come see us again sometime.
She walks off. Anne stares at her. She glances back and minces into the hallway. Bruno appears at another entrance in a loudly patterned dressing gown.
Oh, Miss Morton. I'm afraid that Mother wasn't very much help, was she? Well, you know, she hasn't been well for a long time.
She's a little, well, how shall I say, confused. Poor mother.
He takes a cigar from a box.
You know, I'm very upset with Guy. He shouldn't have sent you on an errand like this.
Guy doesn't know I'm here, Mr. Anthony.
He's been leading you up the garden path, I'm afraid.
He takes Guy's cigarette lighter from his pocket.
He must be very desperate to try to involve me. I've been protecting him ever since that conversation on the train when he told me how much he hated his wife.
He lights the cigar. Anne bites her lip. He perches on the arm of the settee, leaning over her.
Would you know, Miss Morton, that he tried to get me to go back to the island one night after dark to pick up his lighter so that the police wouldn't find it? He dropped it there, you know, when... that night. You see, all the police are waiting for is one piece of evidence to convict Guy of the murder.
He moves away. Anne fights tears.
It's had me so worried. But of course, I couldn't do it, you understand. I mean, it would be too risky. And besides, it would make me an accessory.
She briefly puts her head in her hand. He comes to her.
Oh, Miss Morton, I understand how you feel.
She composes herself.
And now, if you'll excuse me, I have an urgent appointment.
She stubbornly refuses to meet his eye.
No, I really must go now.
She still does not look at him. He moves across the room. As he reaches the hall, he glances back, gives a little wave, and disappears up the stairs. Anne turns away, tears brimming. She shuts her eyes and lowers her head. The American flag flutters on top of a high brick building. Below, on a tree-lined avenue and in a colonnaded concourse, crowds are milling. A packed stadium looks onto a patchwork of tennis courts. Anne and Guy sit on a cafe terrace.
He said if the police ever found your lighter there, that's all they'd need. Something to prove that you were at the scene of the murder.
That lie about my wanting him to get it back means he is going to put my lighter on that island.
Guy, I wanted to help, but I'm afraid all I did is make things worse. My going there right after you did only made him more furious than ever.
No, darling. He said last night he'd think of something.
40-15.
He certainly has.
Guy, you've got to get to Medcalf before he does. You haven't time to play. You better tell them.
40-30.
If that loudspeaker announces I'm not going to play, Hennessy's bound to be suspicious. He'll keep me from ever getting near Medcalf.
Well, then I'll go.
No, Ann. You stay right here and help me give Hennessy the slip after the match.
But, darling, that'll be too late.
Didn't Bruno say I wanted him to go there one night after dark?
Yes.
But that's what's in his mind now. He's not going to expose himself in broad daylight. If I can finish off the match in three sets,
Guy,
I still have to...
Turn in a few minutes, Guy. How are you, Miss Morton?
Okay, Till, I'll be right there.
Guy takes Anne aside.
Look, this is what I think we better do.
Well, if Tully said to pick him up for questioning, let's pick him up.
Let him have his game first, Hammond.
This is the first time I ever waited for a murder suspect to play tennis before I pulled him in. If the boys at headquarters hear about this, they'll send me off.
Hammond and Hennessy are by a stand entrance. Anne and Guy approach.
Good luck, Guy.
Thanks.
Anne and Guy move inside the stand, spectators filing around them.
You got it straight. Just make sure Barbara has everything ready as soon as the third set starts.
She nods and gives his hand a squeeze. He and another player appear on court. They pause before a line of photographers. As Anne sits on a front row seat next to Babs and whispers to her. Before the huge crowd, Guy's opponent spins his racket to decide the serve. They remove their jackets and prepare to play.
Gentlemen, your attention please. This men's singles match will be between Mr. Guy Haynes and Mr. Fred Reynolds.
Babs and Anne and a huge crowd look on in anticipation as the players warm up.
On the other hand, Guy Haynes is a quiet, methodical player, almost lackadaisical. As a rule, he plays slowly between points, well within himself.
Fines and ready? Play.
Guy serves. Reynolds mishits the ball.
15, love.
Guy quickly gets ready to serve again. Reynolds misses.
30, love.
Guy prepares to serve. Reynolds hurries into position. Now Guy mishits.
30, 15.
Babs and Anne look on anxiously as he goes to serve again. Reynolds hits the net.
40-15.
Guy immediately jogs back to the baseline. He gets ready to serve once more.
Four.
Hello.
The players go to change ends. Guy grabs a towel and wipes his face. Reynolds gets a drink. Guy glances at the court clock, 4:20. He strides back on court. Bruno strides out of his house.
Union Station.
He gets in a waiting cab, which drives off. Back at the tennis match.
Guy Haines is hitting harder, hurrying up the play, taking chances I've never seen him take. This is a complete reversal of his usual watch-and-wait strategy.
Babs and Anne watch tensely. Guy is serving again. Babs and Anne applaud nervously. Reynolds slips. He races to the baseline to return the ball. Guy smashes it. A cab drives along a wide road. In the back seat, Bruno lights a cigarette with Guy's lighter and looks out of the window through narrowed eyes. Back on the tennis court, Guy serves. The onlookers are engrossed. Heads follow the ball, this way and that. Babs and Anne, the linesman, Hammond and Hennessy. Bruno's on a train, lighting a cigarette.
Oh, may I have a light, please?
Bruno has Guy's lighter in his hand. With irritation, he produces a book of matches from his pocket and hastily lights the cigarette of his bemused fellow traveller.
Thanks.
The sun glares down on the packed crowd and the players. Guy hits a high lob. Reynolds runs for it and gets it back. Guy smashes.
Well, Guy Haines has copped the first two sets very easily. And if he keeps going, it'll be a straight set win for him, sure.
Look, if he wins this next set, you better have everything ready. Here, give the driver this $10.
I wish I understood what this is all about.
I'll tell you that later. Please hurry.
Babs passes Hennessy, smiling. He smiles back. The game continues. Outside the tennis building, Babs hops out of a cab and pays the driver, glancing in at trousers neatly laid out on the back seat. She leaves. The cab remains.
Morning, love.
She passes Hennessy with another winning smile. He tips his hat to her. She walks down to the front row of the stand and nonchalantly resumes her seat next to Anne. The match moves on.
Game, Mr. Reynolds. Advantage, Mr. Reynolds. Game, Mr. Reynolds. He leads.
I may have spoken too soon a while back when I said that this match looked to be about over. Reynolds is up there right now, knocking on the door.
Game, Mr. Reynolds. Mr. Reynolds wins the third set, with Mr. Haines leading 2-1.
The players change ends. Guy drinks a cup of water while staring at the clock. 5:25. He throws his cup down, agitated. A train pulls into Metcalfe Station. Bruno gets off and walks across the station forecourt, hands buried in his jacket pockets. He pauses to glance at his watch and pulls out the cigarette lighter, studying it. A passerby jogs him. The lighter drops into a drain.
The set score is now 2-1. Guy Haines leading, and we're 10-all in the fourth set. This match, from a quick victory for Haines, has turned into a dogfight.
There you are.
Bruno drags a porter to the drain.
Down there. My cigarette case. It's very valuable.
Down here?
Yes, you've got to get that grating up right away.
What's the trouble?
Two men stop.
Well, can't we do something? I dropped my cigarette case.
Mightn't be any good, mister. Probably gone down a storm drain.
Storm drain?
On the other hand, maybe it lodges on the edge.
Don't they have a trap down there, like under a sink, you know? Well, don't just stand here. Do something.
I guess we could phone the city engineer, all right. Worst he could do would be to tell me to go take a run and jump.
Now, look, mister.
Relax, mister.
I don't want to relax.
Bruno kneels by the drain and pokes a hand through the grating. Back at the match. Guy wins a point.
Game, Mr. Haynes.
Guy Haynes is mighty grim and determined, and he needs but one more game for the entire match.
A small crowd has gathered around Bruno as he pushes his wrist through the narrow grating. The lighter rests on a ledge beneath. He manages to grip it between two fingers, but it slips and settles amongst dead leaves in the gutter below, well out of reach. The match continues, fast and furious.
Just 1 point between Haynes and the match.
Guy smashes the ball into the net. Bruno quivers with effort as he squeezes his arm through the grating. His fingers are now within inches of the lighter. Reynolds misses the ball.
Advantage, Mr. Haynes.
Reynolds serves. And gasps. Eyes tight shut, Bruno forces his hand further into the drain. His fingers waggle uselessly an inch above the lighter.
Advantage, Mr. Haynes.
Bruno's middle fingertip brushes against the lighter. His index finger scoops beneath it. He lifts the lighter between the two fingers, grasps it in his hand, and withdraws his arm from the grating. The crowd of onlookers has grown.
Sure must take a lot of that, whatever it is.
Bruno rushes off.
Game, set, and match, Mr. Haynes.
Guy shakes his opponent's hand, thanks the umpire, and throws his jacket on, glancing at the clock. Babs is happily applauding him. Anne speaks in her ear. Babs gets up and goes. The players leave the court. Guy runs over to Anne, handing her his rackets. Guy strides away in front of the stand and darts up a flight of steps at the end. Powdering her face, Babs approaches Hennessy, who's looking out for Guy.
Isn't it wonderful, Mr. Hennessy? He won! It calls for a celebration! Oh, I'm so sorry!
It's quite all right, please. Let me get it.
Oh, no, please! Anne says you must have dinner with us tonight. Just the family and you and Guy.
Well, I'm afraid I may be out of town.
Would you be with Guy, surely, won't you?
Hennessy! I'm sorry, Hennessy. I wish I could.
Hennessy!
Hammond sees Guy escaping. Hennessy pulls away from Babs to follow Hammond. Guy rushes to the cab.
Yes, sir. Penn Station.
He gets in the back and the cab moves off. Hennessy and Hammond weave through the crowd and get to the road too late. Hennessy stops an oncoming chauffeured car and climbs in the back. He shows his police badge to an elderly lady passenger.
Excuse me, madam, I need your help. We're chasing a man.
Really? How exciting!
In the back of his cab, Guy is pulling on the trousers over his tennis shorts. The cab draws up outside a large station, and Guy leaps out and runs towards a vast lamp-lit concourse crisscrossed with travellers. A second car pulls up outside the station. Hennessy and Hammond pile out. Hammond rushes away. Hennessy exchanges a parting word with the lady and follows. Guy hurries down wide stone steps leading to the concourse, glancing behind him. At the bottom, he hesitates and looks around him. He strides towards a ticket counter. Hennessy and Hammond run down the wide stairs, looking out for Guy. They seem to have lost him. Hammond spots him by the counter, talking to the ticket clerk. They move towards him. Some paces away, they stop, turning their backs and lighting cigarettes. They keep an eye on the counter. They approach when Guy has left the counter.
Where'd that last man buy a ticket for?
Metcalf.
That's good.
That's exactly why we're not getting him. Let him go there. This may lead to something big. Come on, we'll phone Metcalf and let them take over at that end.
Guy boards the train. Under a street lamp, Bruno checks his watch. He looks at the sky, then strolls under the big neon letters into the fairground. At a hot dog stand, he looks at the sky again.
What time does it get dark around here?
The hot dog seller smiles.
What's the hurry? What time does it get dark, I said?
Oh, enough.
Guy is sitting impatiently in the train lounge. A man enters and takes a seat, his shoe catching the shoe of a fellow passenger.
Oh, excuse me.
It's quite all right. Do you know what time we get into Baltimore?
In about 30 minutes, I believe.
Late again.
Guy fidgets. At the fairground, Bruno sits by a tree, reading a paper. A gaunt-looking man approaches.
Nice business he's doing over there since the murder. People want to see the scene of the crime.
They peer over at the people queuing for the magic aisle.
I don't think that's a very nice way to make money.
Well, heck, boatkeepers got to eat too, ain't they? Business fell off something terrible for a while. The smoochers wouldn't go near the place.
I'm afraid I don't know what a smoocher is.
Okay, so I ain't educated.
The man hitches up his trousers and leaves. Bruno looks at the sky. The sun is setting over the magic aisle. From the train, Guy glances behind him at the sky. The sun is dipping below the horizon. With a sigh, he checks his watch. Bruno watches the queue and the sinking sun beyond. A train pulls up at Metcalf Station. Guy gets off and strides across the platform to a taxi stand. He's still wearing his tennis pumps.
Amusement park, quick.
A man leaning against the wall of the station office watches as Guy climbs in and the cab drives away. He goes to a nearby police car.
He's gone to the amusement park.
Car 61F, reporting Guy Haynes' arrival at railroad station. Suspect bound for amusement park and taxi.
Bruno watches the queue for the magic aisle. Night has fallen. Hands in pockets, he gets up, walks slowly past the carousel, and joins the end of the queue. He notices the bright light above the ticket kiosk and pulls the brim of his hat lower. People join the queue behind him. Guy looks out from the back seat of the cab as it drives along a road. At the entrance to the fairground, a police car pulls up. Two plain-clothed cops get out. One with a white trilby walks into the fairground, accompanied by a police officer. The other, Johnny, stays at the entrance and lights a cigarette. At the other side of the road, a cab pulls up. Guy gets out and pays the driver. He's alarmed to see a police car draw up. He crosses the road and goes into the fairground. Lieutenant Campbell gets out of the police car with a plain-clothed colleague.
There he is now. You pick up Johnny there and the two of you follow him down. We'll go around the other way.
The lieutenant and two uniformed policemen dart away. His colleague has a word with Johnny. They go into the fairground. From the queue, Bruno sees the cop in the white trilby and the police officer talking to the boatman.
Good. You see, let us know.
Bruno stays in shadow. Guy strides through the fairground. He pauses, glances back, moves on. Johnny and the other plainclothed cop are tailing him. The kiosk attendant speaks to the boatman.
Any more boats?
He shakes his head. The queue edges forward. Bruno's face comes slowly out of shadow. The boatman glances at him with a frown. Bruno lowers his head.
It'll be a few minutes' wait.
The boatman ponders, looks at Bruno again, and strides onto the pontoon. He speaks to the cop and looks back at Bruno, who casually moves out of the queue towards the carousel. The boatman, cop and policeman are making their way towards him. He looks behind him. A policeman approaches by the side of the carousel. Beyond the other side of the carousel, Bruno catches sight of Guy, who spots him.
Hey, Bruno!
Bruno leaps onto the carousel. Guy goes after him. The cops produce guns. The carousel attendant is shot. He falls on a lever. The carousel accelerates. Two men try jumping aboard but are flung to the ground. Children on the galloping horses enjoy the sudden thrill. Bruno goes to get off, but the ground speeds by too fast. In his hand is the lighter. Guy approaches.
Bruno, give me that lighter!
They struggle. A little boy grins. Two women hang on desperately. Crowds gather to watch.
Everyone stay back, dinner. Stay back, please.
The lieutenant and his boss edge through. The cop arrives with the boatman.
He's on there, sir. That's him.
He's the one. He's the one who killed her.
Of course he is. We know that.
Guy and Bruno fight as the painted horses rise and fall around them.
Get someone to stop this thing.
I can handle it.
A wiry old man with wizened face gets to his knees and crawls towards the carousel. He ducks his head beneath the spinning platform.
Hey, be careful. Stop. Well, do you want to do it yourself?
No, I guess he can make it all right.
The old man edges underneath. Guy loses his grip and grabs a pair of reins to save himself. A girl clings desperately to her horse as it bucks violently beneath her. The crowd and fairground lights spin by in a blur. Bruno grabs Guy by the collar. Guy slips, but reaches for a pole above a bobbing horse. He punches Bruno, who falls to the floor. A woman struggles in the crowd. Her little boy is riding a horse behind the fighting men. He's grinning from ear to ear, the two men edging closer to him as they slog it out. Beneath the platform, the old man slithers closer to the center of the carousel. Bruno punches Guy. The little boy joins in, gleefully walloping Bruno on the shoulder. Bruno shoves the boy, who falls to the edge of the platform. Guy scoops him out of danger and places him in an open carriage. Bruno comes at Guy from behind, grabs him round the neck and pulls him to the floor, his hands at Guy's throat. Guy struggles backwards, Bruno on top of him, the hooves of the painted horses plunging around them ever faster. A terrified girl holds on for dear life, her arms flung around her horse's neck. Still grappling on the floor, Bruno punches Guy, forcing his head closer to the sharp edge of a hoof that rises and falls inches from his face. The shiny horse above them gallops mechanically on, its black hoof ready to crush Guy's forehead. The two women and a mother with a child hang on, distraught. Guy has pulled away from the hooves, but Bruno is gradually pushing him off the platform with his feet. Guy grabs a pole to stop himself being flung off the spinning carousel. Bruno kicks viciously at Guy's hand. Guy winces, but hangs on. The old man pauses, licking his lips, the platform whirling inches above his head. He wipes his face and edges forward. Guy's legs flail out behind him as he grips the pole. Bruno stamps Guy's knuckles. The old man emerges at the center of the carousel. He gets to his feet and yanks at a lever. A belt on the drive wheel snaps and tangles. The central shaft fractures. The platform lurches violently. Horses dislodge and scatter. The crowd recoils. The carousel collapses in a tangle of wreckage and smoke. The crowd surge forward. Guy is clutching his neck as the lieutenant leads him to Captain Turley.
Are you all right, Haynes?
Yeah, I think so.
Captain Turley! Captain Turley! He says this isn't the man we want. It's the other one, the one he was fighting with.
What do you mean this isn't it? Not Haynes, but you said he was. You pointed him out.
No, I didn't, sir. I've never seen this man before in my life. I meant the other one.
What's this all about, Haynes?
He has my cigarette lighter. He wanted to plant it there on the island to pin the whole thing on me. Let me talk to him. Let me show you. Where is he?
Over here. Take it easy.
They hurry to a group of men amidst the wreckage who are huddled around Bruno. His eyes are closed.
This was a pretty bad way, Mr. Turley.
Can't you get that stuff off of him?
Well, they've done everything they can till the crane comes.
Bruno's eyes open.
Hello, Guy. Who's this?
This is Mr. Turley, the chief of police.
They got you at last, huh, Guy?
Bruno, can you talk a little? Can you tell the chief you have my lighter?
I haven't got it. It's on the island where you left it.
Bruno, don't keep it up. Not at a time like this. You know that...
I'm sorry, Guy. I want to help you, but I don't know what I can do.
Captain Turley, look, can't I go through his pockets?
No, Haynes, of course you can't.
Besides, he says he hasn't got it.
I think he's going.
Guy looks at Bruno. Bruno's eyes are closed. His head lolls.
He's finished.
Bruno's clenched hand loosens to reveal the cigarette lighter. A to G, crisscrossed rackets. Captain Turley picks it up and shows it to Guy.
Is this it? Well, you were right. Better keep this for the time being. We'll clear the whole thing up in the morning. How about staying in town overnight, Ames? I imagine there's a lot you want to tell me. 9 o'clock, all right?
Okay, Captain Turley.
Thanks.
Guy glances at Bruno, then turns to the boatman.
Can you tell me where there's a telephone?
There's one up near the entrance. Who was he, bud?
Bruno. Bruno Anthony. Very clever fellow.
They move away through the fairground. At the senator's house, Anne rushes to the phone. Babs and her father look on.
Hello? Yes, operator, yes. Guy? Yes, darling, yes. Well, of course I'll be there. Goodbye. Guy will be back tomorrow. He wants me to bring him some...
Babs runs to hug her. In a train, Guy and Anne hold hands, talking happily. A man in a dog collar looks up from his paper.
I beg your pardon, but aren't you Guy Haines?
Guy smiles and is about to reply. He hesitates. He and Anne glance at each other and leave the carriage. The minister shrugs and goes back to his paper. The End. Produced and distributed by Warner Brothers Pictures. The portly gentleman boarding the train with the double bass was played by Alfred Hitchcock.